Hello and welcome to Martian Drive-In Podcast 128. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around it is time for another Marvel movie, and I have a guest on board. So the movie is Black Panther, of course, which is just one of the most interesting Marvel movies I've ever seen, if not the most interesting. And I've got a guest, Lucas Garrett, who is a pop culture polymath. He knows about pulp novels. He knows about DC and Marvel. He is a James Bond fan as well. And we've been friends on Facebook for a while, but this is the first time we've actually spoken. So Lucas and I get together. And one of the reasons we're doing it is I wanted a Black American perspective on Black Panther. I could give my perspective, but Lucas brought so much more to the table than I possibly could. And we had a great chat and got on really well. And I'm very happy about that. It's always nice when you get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, get on Skype and make a new friend. And that's never a bad thing. So I'm going to get the contact details out of the way, and then Lucas and I are going to talk about T'Challa, Wakanda, and the whole damn thing. Martian Drive-In Podcast is a two-weekly podcast about science fiction, fantasy, and other genres, cinema and television. From George Méliès to the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the DC Extended Universe, anything's up for grabs in this podcast. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. And if you want to give feedback, you can go to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com and leave a voicemail or an email message. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, adult concepts and words may turn up. So if you're going to be listening to them with kids around, put on the headphones. Or if you can't do that, you're going to have a lot of explaining to do. Okay, so how is everybody? We're doing kind of okay here. It's still warm, fortunately. I did a really long drive the other day. I did 800 kilometers in a day. There's a town at the northwest corner of the state of Victoria in which I live called Rainbow, and I thought I'd fang it up there in the car. I do these things semi-regularly because it just clears my mind out. It's nice to just get in the car, put the cruise control on, go to somewhere I've never been before while playing rhythm and blues really loudly in the car stereo. And that's pretty much what I did. Went up to Warracknabeal and Rainbow. You can look these up on Google Maps if you want to. Lovely little towns in the wheat belt up in the northern part of the state. They're not particularly wealthy towns. They're a little bit run down. They've got some historical buildings in them, but they're not doing particularly well financially in these times when everybody needs to be in a city close to the coast. And but still, it was good to do that. I did enjoy it a lot. I did. I started out at 4 in the morning and got home at about 3 in the afternoon. And it's a really cleansing kind of thing because you're in the moment. I've got to concentrate on the driving. Even though there was a fallen tree across one of the roads unexpectedly, it didn't happen while I was there, but a big gum tree fell across two lane road pretty much. And I saw a wallaby just nearby, which is kind of cool. You haven't lived until you've been on a country drive and seen marsupials. It's just part of the ritual of being an Australian in a sense. So I did that, and that was a lot of fun. Of course, Black Panther, which I'm going to talk about with Lucas in a moment. And it's been a kind of still in a transitional time for me into retirement, or at least kind of cutting back on any kind of work in the future. But it's a good thing. I keep evaluating it against the last 3 or 4 years of my work life, and it kind of comes up as a lot less stressful. I can stay up late if I want to. I can drink a little extra coffee if I want to. Any obligations I make are of my making. They're not arbitrarily put on me by a corporation, which is, until you've done it, you don't know how good that is. And yeah, life is not a bad thing. So I'm doing that. Next month, Sally and I are going up to Sydney for my nephew's birthday. So we've got another road trip on the way for that. And I'm kind of slowly but surely talking her into the idea of driving across the country to Western Australia. We've been to Western Australia by plane, but again, it's one of those bucket list things, driving across to WA and back. I've done it, she hasn't. And so I'm slowly but surely trying to convince her to do so. And if you listen to this and you're a Facebook friend of either or both of us, you should send her a Facebook message saying you really should drive to Western Australia. Just do that. We'll do a little bit of a viral bombardment on it. But anyway, I'm going to play a little bit of music now. And when I get back, Lucas and I are going to talk about Black Panther.
Baby, don't make me spell it out for ya. All of the feelings that I got for ya can't be explained, but I can try for ya. Yeah, baby, don't make me spell it out for ya. You keep on asking me the same questions. Why? And second guessing all my intentions. Should know by the way I use my compression that you got the answers to my confessions. It's like I'm powerful with a little bit of tender and emotional sexual bender. Mess me up, yeah, but no one does it better. There's nothing better. That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you
So it's so good, so fucking real. That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel.
You know I love you, so please don't stop it.
You got me right here in your jean pocket right now, laying your body on a shag carpet. Ooh. You know I love you, so please don't stop it. It's like I'm sexual bender. Mess me up, yeah, but no one does it better. There's nothing better.
Oh.
That's just the way you make me feel.
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 So good, so good, so fucking real. That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel. That's just the way you make me feel.
That's just the way you make me feel.
There's a bit of Janelle Monáe for you, and I'm going to get on with the recording I did with Lucas. By the way, the sound quality is a little bit ropey at times. I apologize for that. I tried to clean it up as much as I could, but next time I hope for better. Well, I've got a guest this time around on Martian Drive-In Podcast, Lucas Garrett from Atlanta, and we're going to be talking about Black Panther. So, hi, Lucas. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Terry?
Doing pretty good. It's 5 o'clock in the morning here, so I'm caffeinated, but I'm ready to go.
Very good.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the kind of things you like and who you are, and we'll kind of move on from there.
Yeah, as I said on my Facebook page, I've been in the security industry, mostly unarmed, for almost 20 years. Did a stint in the Marine Corps for 8 years and was a building engineer. But on my personal level, I'm just pretty much a geek who like comic books, video games, movies, can talk the ear off of almost anybody who wants to hear it. But I've been pretty much a fan of all of this ever since I was a kid. I remember my dad, he bought me a comic book, about maybe two or three comic books at a food mart over on, near Lawrenceville. And these three comic books pretty much changed my life. I was already a Marvel fan growing up with the Spider-Man, the Amazing Friends, the X-Men, were introduced in there, and then they had the Pride of the X-Men, which I knew about, but I never saw until much later. And so for me, it just kept going. And so here we are now, some 30-odd years, and we get to reap the benefits of all that stuff. So it's a fun time.
Yeah, I believe you're big in Pulp Fiction as well and James Bond.
Absolutely. Yeah, that came about pretty much because there was a time when I got tired of comics. They got a little bit too out of control for my taste. And so I said, I need to find something a little bit more grounded. So I found a book. It was by Philip Jose Farmer called Tarzan Alive, which talked about the possibility that Tarzan actually does exist and was based on somebody historical. And then there was a follow-up book called Doc Savage's Apocalyptic Life, which went by the same premise that Doc was also based on somebody who had similar adventures, but not as outlandish. And so from that point on, I guess this would have been the late 90s or 2000s, I just got into pretty much big family trees. Of course, I can both thank and blame Ron Fortier and Jeff Butler for the Now Comics great series of Green Hornet comics back in the day, for that love of crossovers, as well as just pretty much a long drama of vigilante heroes and their families and their friends. And so pretty much all I have to do is look at Green Hornet number 2 from Now Comics back in 1989 for just everything. And so I kind of appreciate it more as I get older, all that stuff that went back in those days, and you know how I'm able to see all this, you know, literature and fiction. So it's been fun.
Yeah, I'm getting a little bit into that stuff myself. I just downloaded the English translations of the Fantomas novels, the first five of those.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he's an interesting, you know, very complex character, possibly one of the most interesting of the 19th century literature characters that you'll come across, other than maybe Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde on a psychological level, and then you have other characters such as Arsène Lupin, who pretty much was a forerunner to the saint that the late great Roger Moore played back in the 1960s. It all builds on each other, and that's the thing that I love so much, is that there's nothing new under the sun. Like my dad used to quote, you know, from Solomon, and it's so true. We take the fiction that we grew up with and that our fathers and grandfathers and moms and grandmothers knew, and we just make a whole new interpretation of it. But it's all the same thing. It's just done by a different angle. And that's really just how you have to look at it. Like, for instance, our subject today is the Panther, Black Panther. If you look at him, I see easily he's made up of maybe three or four characters in the past. First off, predominantly, and one that's little known, is the Lion Man. Mm-hmm. If you go back in the past, in 1946, there was an all-Negro comics that was done by Orrin Evans, and was only lasted for one issue. And if you look at his character, he was a physicist who worked for the United Nations, who had a lab, and his whole thing was to stop poachers. And anybody trying to mess with Africa as a whole. It only lasted one issue. And then you gotta go a little bit back and look at the comic strip of the Phantom. And the Black Panther definitely takes elements of the Phantom and runs with it. And it says, what if the Black Panther pretty much was like the Phantom, but instead of having Phantom Island or Skull Island, you have the whole nation
Yeah.
So it's just all there.
Absolutely. And, I mean, for me, it kind of started out with reading Heroes for Hire and the Luke Cage comics back in the 70s.
Mm-hmm. And, oh, yes.
Yeah, so that's where I came into it. And Australia had this big thing where we were looking for cheap things to show in cinemas. So we got tons of blaxploitation movies out here in the cheap cinemas. And that kind of introduced me to black culture in a lot of ways, even though it was very skewed and a lot of it was done by white guys at the start. It kind of got me into the music. It got me into everything like that. So, yeah, and mashups I love. The whole Wald Newton thing is just a fantastic little rabbit hole to dive down and you'll never come out again.
Absolutely, because then you have to wonder, like, huh, okay, I know this is somewhat fantastical, but let's break it down. And it's interesting, all these different YouTube videos I've been watching as of late, talking about the history that went into, like, say, Black Panther, almost on the Wald Newton level, about all the African tribes and different, you know, organizations that definitely influenced the Black Panther, not just the Black Panther party, but certain Pan-African groups, certain ancient societies. There's a webpage on YouTube that I would definitely tell people to go to. It's called African Creation Energy, and it is it definitely breaks down the whole history of where all the elements of the Black Panther comes from. Everything from vibranium, everything from the Orisha, which are the various African mythologies. And the interesting thing is that as I was watching it, you could almost say that Black Panther is in and of itself it's almost like a hidden text word, really.
Yeah.
Because really, he is really the panther of the blacksmiths of Africa. Because, as you know, Wakanda is highly technological, but it is pretty much the heirs of African blacksmiths and technicians and engineers who pretty much built this village that later became a nation.
Yeah.
And so it's been very interesting. And to have these two videos that he has, he's able to just literally go all the way back to the time of the Egyptians. And then so it's almost like what happened with Philip Jose Farmer when he went back and said, okay, how much of what Edgar Rice Burroughs did with Tarzan can actually have some type of reality behind it? We're not expecting Opar, but what do we know? And the same thing with Doc Savage, because if you look at it, he called his he was able to find quote unquote the real names for some of these guys, but there was in fact a Dr. James Clark Wildman. I doubt very highly he was Doc.
Yep.
Savage, but it's there. So it's all there. And what you really realize is that life is a lot stranger than fiction. Fiction only scratches the surface.
Absolutely. So just to step back a little bit, what have you been watching and absorbing lately that's real, apart from Black Panther right now? What else have you been looking at that's been grabbing you?
Well, at the moment, I've just finally finished watching The Librarians. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to lie, that has been one of the strongest seasons that they've had. It's whimsical, but when they want to go dark, they can go dark. And it's mostly on a subconscious and even psychological level of what does it mean to be a librarian in a world where magic has been unleashed onto the planet and still be able to be a curator of all these artifacts and not give in to your own personal impulses. It's been pretty good on that. As far as where superhero fiction, I kind of dialed it back some. I'm kind of waiting for the Flash, Arrow, Legends of Tomorrow, Supergirl, and Black Lightning to fall into Netflix so I can watch all of them and just binge watch them, as opposed to just wait week after week after week. Because I kind of got over the fact that these shows go on hiatus, and now what's going on with them definitely going on hiatus, and certain shows now almost being put on certain nights as opposed to just they all have a, you know, set schedule.
Yeah.
That's been an issue. Also, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. with this one, they're definitely showing how, the effects of time travel. Whereas last season was, what would we do if we create a living, breathing Skynet? What would happen if the ramifications afterwards is gravitonium? And that goes back to season one with Franklin Hall, who they had to unfortunately imprison. And, of course, he wound up in the gravitonium. So he might very well come back in this second arc. But seeing the effects in the future and seeing just how bad the Kree are, it's been something. So the librarians and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. have been, for me, must-see TV. Now, the magicians have started out interesting, but I'm kind of waiting even for that one to just do what they have to do, because they're getting a little bit outlandish for my taste.
Yeah.
What about you?
Well, we've got the first three seasons of The Magicians on DVD, but I haven't had a chance to binge it yet. I did pick up a disc that was kind of cool, Batman Gotham by Gaslight, which is the alternate universe Batman set in kind of Victorian era, done at Disney, DC Animation. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty cool. I mean, they go quite adult with it. And while the animation's fairly basic, they've got Selina Kyle in there. They've got Poison Ivy in there. They've got Commissioner Gordon and all those sorts of things in a late 19th century kind of environment. And Jack the Ripper's kind of killer, and you've got to find out which of the characters is Jack the Ripper. And it's kind of cool. It does work. I think that they brushed it slightly, so there's a little less texture to it than I would have liked. But
yeah, because the books have a lot more texture. Yeah. The books have a lot more texture. And I remember when that book actually came out, and I said, well, this is just pure genius, because what would Batman do against Jack the Ripper back then? You know, when they get to do those Elseworlds what-if stories, that's what gets me more interested than just the run-of-the-mill of, oh, yeah, Batman, once again, got to deal with the Joker or the Penguin or the Riddler or whoever. Let's see what he would have been like back in the late 19th century when the Ripper case was happening. Instead of it being Sherlock Holmes, it's just Bruce Wayne in a makeshift, you know, costume that's definitely Victorian. And he just happens to be battling and trying to solve the case of who is doing all these heinous murders.
Yeah, it's quite solid and it's worth watching. Speaking of Sherlock Holmes, I've been on YouTube and I've been watching a whole bunch of the Basil Rathbone, Nigel Bruce Sherlock Holmes movies. And I'm enjoying those a lot too. They're very much of their time, and Dr. Watson is a bit of a dill. But they're kind of, you know, about an hour, hour and 10 minutes long, so you can watch a few of them. And watching Rathbone do his stuff is a lot of fun. It was kind of nice to see the ones that I hadn't seen before and revisit ones like Spider-Woman with Gail Sondergaard in it, where she's just having a lot of fun playing a villain.
Yes.
They're great, and they're all on YouTube. Those are on there. The Charlie Chan movies with Warner Oland and Sidney Toller are on there. And they're all pretty good prints too, so it's not like scratchy, ugly-looking prints. They're all quality stuff, and they're all out there, and they're a lot of fun to kind of dive into.
Yeah, I got into that when I actually, and this is really, until they actually shut it down, Internet Archive has all that. All that material, all you have to do is just go there and just put Basil Rathbone, Sherlock Holmes, and you will get his entire collection right there for you to see and watch. And most of it is pretty much just LinkedIn, YouTube footage.
Yeah.
But the fact is that the material is out there, and the fact that nobody is even bothering to watch is baffling to me. Because if you really want to get to the meat of it, of cinematic Holmes, it starts with him. Then afterwards, you get the great Peter, Peter Cushing with his film. Then you get my boy, who for me, he is my Sherlock Holmes. And that's Jeremy Brett.
Yeah.
And his series that used to run on PBS, where I am. And I used to watch that as a kid every Sunday. They used to always run that before Masterpiece Theater. And, I mean, it broke my heart when he passed away. Because for me, even still, as much as I love Basil, when I read Sherlock Holmes, it's Jeremy Brett's voice and it's his face and mannerism that I see.
Yeah, for a lot of people now, it'll be Benedict Cumberbatch. But I don't think...
Oh, yes.
I don't think he's kind of quite there. I think he's very much a 21st century Holmes. Uh-huh. But
I absolutely agree. And the thing that really got my nerves was the recent Christmas special that they did in period. And I'm saying, well, you guys could have did this all along.
Yeah.
Because he really knocked out – he and John Freeman, they really knocked it out – Martin Freeman, yeah. They really knocked it out the park when it concerned the portrayal of the classic The Strand,
yeah.
Sherlock Holmes and John Watson. It was a great episode. It was just like, you guys could have did this all along. What is this of you guys putting it in the here and now? Because, yes, it's interesting, but – it kind of loses its power in a sense.
Yeah, I think also as far as I'm concerned. One of the reasons they may have done that is they were scared of the audience. They were scared the audience wouldn't come along for the journey unless they made it contemporary. And
yeah, well, things is this, Terry, that's possible, but they did Ripper Street. Mm. And Ripper Street was possibly some of the most compelling television that you could have watched at that time. Yeah. And it would have been that hard for them to have done something on like Ripper Street when it concerns Sherlock. But instead of them being in, at that time, modern-day London, we get period piece, but we get a different take on it. We get almost like a, I wouldn't say a Robert Downey Jr., Jude Law, Sherlock Holmes take, but it will still be a fresh take on an old character, but say it's still back in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And things like Penny Dreadful. I mean, I enjoyed Penny Dreadful while it was running.
Yeah.
It went crazy dark and really kind
of
did the great thing, which was getting in really fine actors to do the gig. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the interesting things I'm finding with things. I did on the radio about a week ago, The Shape of Water, when I did the ABC radio gig I do. And one of the things I noticed is that all of the major actors in that had really great stage experience. They weren't just film actors or TV actors. They'd actually...
So they were Shakespearean. They had the craft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They'd done the hard yards and in some cases for decades before they got famous, like Richard Jenkins, did mm-hmm. the hard things on stage and in repertory theatre. And it shows. It just makes them shine and give a lived-in character. And in fact, you get that mm-hmm. with some of the actors in Black Panther as well. But one of the things I'm doing with anything I'm watching at the moment is go back into the history of the actors, and sure enough, the ones that you really like in the series, overwhelmingly, they will be people with stage experience, and that's a absolutely. Really cool thing.
I agree, Terry. Yeah, so. Because for them, it matters. You know, it's not just, oh, we just got you off the streets, and you may have done one or two movies. No, you've literally made this your bread and butter. You've made this your life, and you actually have delved into it. And that's another reason why Black Panther, when I look at the stage presence, the power that's there, even with the new young individuals, they are learning from the masters. They're learning from Forest Whitaker. They're learning from Angela Bassett. They're learning from John Connie. This is now their age, but they have so much support from what has already come behind. And even those who I just said, who just named, they themselves, they can go on forever if they wanted to. And that's what the whole power of that whole movie was that this is multi-generational story from beginning to end. And it really is a one big family drama.
Absolutely.
That has political consequences for everything that came before and everything that's going to go on well after.
Yeah. Well, tell you what, I'll throw the trailer for Black Panther in at this stage.
I have seen gods fly. I've seen men build weapons that I couldn't even imagine.
Uh-huh.
I've seen aliens drop from the sky.
Yeah.
But I have never seen anything like this. How much more are you hiding?
Hola. Let's go, go.
My son, it is your time.
Show me my respect and bow down.
You get to decide what kind of king you are going to be. Don't freeze.
I never freeze.
The revolution will not be televised.
Show me my respect and bow down. We own ya, we own ya. We only getting started now, cause we own ya. You gotta think they know me now, cause we own ya. You and I my homie now, cause we own ya.
I waited my entire life for this. The world's gonna start over. I'ma burn it all.
What happens now determines what happens to the rest of the world.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out.
What's going on forever?
The revolution will not be televised.
Let's have some fun.
Okay, so that's the trailer for Black Panther. We all pretty much know the story. T'Challa, the king of Wakanda, his father, T'Chaka, has been killed, and he needs to come into his own as the king of his kingdom and to confront not only his family past, but the past of his nation and where Wakanda goes in a world where they can't stay isolationist long term. We've got tons of fantastic actors in there. You've got Channing Boseman playing T'Challa, Michael B. Jordan playing the kind of dark shadow version of him, Eric Killmonger Stevens, who's has a long history, and we get a bit of backstory on him. We've got Lupita Nyong'o as Nakia, who is the spy for Wakanda and is quite close to T'Challa. We've got Danai Gurira as Okoye, Martin Freeman playing Everett K. Ross, who we saw in Civil War, Daniel Kaluuya as Wakabi, Letitia Wright as T'Challa's sister Shuri, Winston Duke as M'Baku, who's the head of the Jabari tribe, Angela Bassett as Queen Ramonda, Forest Whitaker as Zuri, who's a kind of elder priest figure in Wakanda, and then you got good old Andy Serkis as Ulysses Claw, the bad guy. So I'm going to let you lead with this one. Tell me about Black Panther.
Well, I've been a fan of Black Panther for almost 30 years, Terry, and he is by far my favorite character. He is, well, I would say, he is the African ninja warlord of his own technological society. That he himself, if you look at the original stories, the technology that Jack Kirby incorporated was pretty much all of T'Challa's making. And there's a part of me that is of two minds of whether or not that origin has just stayed as it is, that every time we saw something new being built, it should have been by King T'Challa, as opposed to, oh, Wakanda has always been like this. But at the same time, I kind of understand why they drifted off from that, and it kind of makes Wakanda stronger. But as far as where the story is concerned, this for me is my favorite of all the Marvel Cinematic Universe films. Now, does it have its problems? Absolutely. But as far as where a nice, concise story that you can follow from beginning to end, you can't get anything better than this. You really can't, not as far as I'm concerned. Because what we, like I said earlier, what we're dealing with is a big family drama that has its origins in this accidental dispute between brothers in Oakland City, in Oakland, California, in 1992. That has far-reaching ramifications. And the ramifications is this. And since this is spoilers, am I correct?
Yeah, we're going to do spoilers because if correct. People haven't seen it, go and see it and then listen to the rest of the podcast because we're going to be diving deep and we don't want to ruin the movie for anyone.
Yes. Okay. The whole crux of this movie is that T'Challa's father, T'Chaka, back in 1992, accidentally killed his brother. His own brother was responsible for Ulysses Claw getting the vibranium from Wakanda, but his explanation actually makes sense. if you look at the history, and I had to really rethink about the origin story, which was a good 2 minutes, possibly the best 2 minutes of cinema I've seen in a while, where I talk about the history of Wakanda, about the first Black Panther, who was Bashanga in the comics, who was never named in the actual movie. But you see him unite the five tribes, you see that being the birth of Wakanda. Now, initially, I thought that it was T'Chaka telling this to young T'Challa when he was a kid. Now I think that it was T'Chaka's brother telling it to little Eric Killmonger, Stevens. And so because, you know, Eric had always wanted to go to Wakanda.
Yeah.
You know, this was his family. This was his land. But his father was on assignment. But the thing is this, his father was deep cover. He was a deep cover spy. And there was multiple spies sent out from Wakanda to see what the rest of the world was doing. Not for any type of gain, but to see, is it possible for us to actually interact with the rest of the world? We need to know what their politics are. We need to know what their societies are. So that in the off chance that we decide to change our policy of being isolationists, they will be more welcoming. His brother comes in and he realizes that the rest of the world out here is very bad, especially for people of color, and says, we could have stopped all of this. We have the technology, we have the means, we have the troops to go in and change the whole world. Why aren't we doing this, brother?
And that's the lovely thing about Killmonger as a character is his arguments are valid. It's the way he applies.
He was right.
The way he applies himself to the arguments is the problematic stuff. The stuff in the British Museum, for instance, the way he did that with Claw helping him was a problem. We know that what he's saying is valid. There's a strong argument for what he's saying, but he only knows violence because he's got that kind of black ops background. And there are subtler ways he could have gone about what he did, but he chose the path that he knew, and he chose the path that was simpler for him, and drifted from the straight and narrow by doing that. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting because having a villain in the Marvel Universe who you can actually say, yeah, you've got a point, rather than just having them be a great big CGI bad guy, is a game changer. Apart from all the other game changers that Black Panther is, it's a game changer for the MCU.
And I'll be honest with you, a lot of people online, as well as even people who I've spoken to, have said that Loki is the best MCU villain. I would say that Eric probably got him by about a good few inches as far as where that, because this is a kid who, you know, came home after having a basketball match outside, sees the aircraft that his uncle flew out in the cover of night, only to find his father dead. Mm-hmm. It changes. The trauma alone changes this kid.
Yeah.
And so, for me, there's no justification for his acts as far as where the ends justify the means. But when it concerns why he did it, I completely and totally understand it. I get it.
Absolutely.
But you're right. You can't just do business with the devil and not think that that's not going to corrupt you. And that's exactly what he did by going into a partnership with Ulysses Klaue. Because I think even then he knew that he was always going to kill Ulysses Klaue.
Yeah.
Always knew he was going to do that. He was just waiting for the opportune moment to do it. And that's the sad part, is that with the loss of his father at such a young age, his perspective of life changes. But that's how life is. Life will hit you sideways.
Yeah.
But it's up to you to decide how you react to it. So we see him, and you're saying, yeah, man, you're right. But, dude, you know, you just threw your nephew, you did not nephew, you threw your cousin off of a cliff.
Mm.
You just completely and totally disrupted Wakanda. And don't get me wrong, I get it. You're angry. I mean, if Anakin Skywalker has shown more level of this type of depth, a lot more people would not have such an issue with the prequel films. I had no issue with the prequel films. But at the same time, some of the arguments kind of make sense. This guy here, you could see it written on his face. But at the same time, he's as cunning as a Bond villain as well. And that's another reason why I love this. If you were to apply The Godfather meets James Bond 007, merge them together, add Afrofuturism, add various African mythologies, and cobbled all together with superhuman fighting, this is what you get. You get all this distilled into one movie.
Yeah.
And that's the magic of what Ryan Coogler, Kevin Feige, and this outstanding cast did. And they did this.
Yeah, a lot of people have been saying online too, which is an interesting comparison. If you compare and contrast Tony Stark and the death of his parents with the way that T'Challa handles the death of his father, where he's got obligations and he's got to man up and move past that to a big extent and hold together a nation, whereas Tony Stark decides to go after the Winter Soldier because you killed my mum and I don't care that you weren't responsible for it, I'm going to take you down. There's a more kind of adult human being in T'Challa than there is in Tony Stark, and I find that really interesting.
I agree. And like I said, it's all about responses. Kind of look at it, and that's what I love so much, and I cannot wait until somebody on YouTube comes in, and after all this is done, said and done, and they do a Marvel chronology, you get to go all the way back to the beginning and then well until the end, and you get to see the relationships, because that's really what matters the most, not just the events, but the relationships. And what you find with Tony is this: he didn't reconcile with his dad until Iron Man 2.
Yeah.
He always thought that his father possibly thought lesser of him, even though he knew his father knew he had a lot of potential. But he was able to always have his mother to fall back on. And I hate to say that, but it's almost like all of us. Even if, say, somebody were to kill the mother that you loved and, you know, whatever, but they were under either duress or crazy, I can't fault Tony for wanting to kill Winter Soldier, even though I know that Bucky had no cognitive choice on the matter. He didn't have complete control of his functions.
Yeah.
He was a weapon used by Hydra and Leviathan to kill the Starks, and that's exactly what he did. But it's like being, you not only do the act, but you are aware of it, but you can't stop yourself. So when he told Tony, when he responded to Tony, Tony asked him, did you even know what you were doing? Did you even remember her name? And he told him, I remember all of them. That in of itself is his own nightmare. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you're being under control. You don't have no control of your functions, but you're being directed and you just do it. And you cannot fight back against that kind of control. So for me, one of the things that makes Civil War so impactful, more impactful than Batman v Superman, is the fact that we're dealing with characters that we've had time to grow with ever since 2008.
Yep.
And we get to see the fallout of that relationship between Tony and Steve. And that's another reason why I don't think that's the reason why I don't think that Steve was able to lift Thor's hammer. He's in the comic is able to lift Thor's hammer. But the one thing that possibly caused him not to was the fact that he knew that Bucky had killed Tony's parents back in 1991. And he was holding off on it because, like most people, he's like saying, how do I come with this information and say that, yes, my best friend back in the 40s, who everybody thought was dead, is the reason why your parents are no longer here. You know, how can he reconcile that? And he don't have that issue with that with T'Challa. T'Challa's like, I find out that was Zemo and so forth, but I still miss my father. And I still don't think I'm as great of a king as my father. But as life always shows us, the people who we always think are our heroes, they're just as human as us. And they make human mistakes. And you have to be able to grow from that. And that's one of the powerful themes about this film, is that you're dealing with a young king who's having to say, no, you were wrong. You know you're wrong. But at the same time, I cannot, you know, say that I don't understand. I can't say I don't understand it. Because I do understand. I understand why you did it, you know, even though it was accidental, because it was for the state of Wakanda. Wakanda, at that time, had to remain like it was. Very silent, very well hidden, so that any of the drama that was going on in the rest of the world would not come find Wakanda, especially with that technology at the time. But at the same time, your brother's dead, and your brother meant well. Your brother was about to literally do a worldwide revolution to say, you know what, all these assassinations, all these police brutalities, it stops now. And the sad part is this. You know, I tend to think that Zuri would have possibly been behind him if he didn't find out that T'Chaka's brother was in league with Ulysses Klaue.
Yeah.
And that's the sad part, because you see it when he explains, when Zuri explains it to T'Challa, and you see that anguish. You see, you know, that, man, I wish I could have just taken it back. But your father, you know, your uncle's gone.
Sure.
He got in bed with a devil who we've been hunting for decades. And he was the reason why all this had happened. And I had no choice but to tell my king, your father, that this had happened.
Yeah. So yeah. Just to look at it from a personal viewpoint, what does representation mean in the context of Black Panther for you?
For me, it means that we have something new to give. Not just the fact that, kids will be able to read other comics, but they will be able to see people who look like them. They will be able to say, you know what, we don't have to be the drug dealers. We don't have to be anything that, you know, we have seen so far in the media. We can be whatever we want to be. We could be kings. We could be queens. We could be scientists. We could be engineers. We could be doctors. We'd be whatever we want to, because kids are impressionable.
Yeah.
And this is what is best for me, is that you, and it's interesting. I saw this movie yesterday with my little brother, and we took pictures, but there was a father, a mother, and their two children that they took. And I just saw that whole family beaming, and I'm saying, this has always been necessary. But we ourselves have to make that. You know, at the end of the day, Hollywood is ruled by really one color, and that's green.
Yeah.
It's been allowed that when you see these type of characters, they usually are garden variety, Caucasian, and so forth. Very rarely do you get a chance to see, no, you get an African, but not just that. You get a king. He has his own technological society. Because maybe later on, we'll get maybe Shang-Chi, the master of Kung Fu.
I'm looking forward to that.
It's the possibilities of what Black Panther has done. And people say, oh, man, it's just a comic book movie. They're not understanding that this pretty much was the watershed movie of the MCU. Because after this, there's no excuse for nothing else coming in.
Yeah.
There's nothing. I mean, Kevin Feige cannot say, oh, well, I don't think we can do that. Really? Well, we just did this, and we made gamebusters.
Yeah.
So what are you talking about?
Well, the interesting thing is, in 4 days, Black Panther's made as much money as Justice League made in its entire run. Mm-hmm. That's got to count for something, particularly in Hollywood.
Not just that, but also you got to think about this too, Terry. I've never seen a marketing campaign as strong as the one that was thrown behind Black Panther. When it concerns marketing executives and those who are going to school for marketing, this is the course that you need to teach to get that buzz going. But the buzz has been building for 5 years. And it would have been 4 if, you know, Black Panther had released on the same day that Thor Ragnarok had released. But we got Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And the need for Spider-Man was greater. And I don't fault it, because now it's almost like they knew when best to release it. Initially, I said, oh, come on. You're going to release Black Panther on February, which is Black History Month? Come on. That's kind of a little, you know, insensitive.
Yep.
But if you really look at it, it actually works, because what you have is this. You have a timetable. You have Black Panther, then Infinity War, and then Ant-Man and the Wasp. You have 3 stories that are all connected, and you get to see the pregame, but a very important pregame, then the main game, and then whatever was going on in the side game. Because I tend to think that Ant-Man and the Wasp takes place either a little bit before or around the same time that Infinity War happens.
Yeah.
And this is all between February and July.
Yeah, I mean,
that's masterful.
Yeah. And for me, with the MCU, one of the interesting things for me is I like the MCU movies that are about people off to one side. You've got a man who's got a disability in Doctor Strange. His hand's crippled, and he's got to mm-hmm. learn to deal with disability. You've got Ant-Man, where basically he's a working-class poor guy who drifted into mm-hmm. crime because he was a smart engineer and didn't have any other options. Mm-hmm. And you've got the marginalized people being reflected in Black Panther. Those are the most interesting MCU movies. It's not the rich kind of Tony Stark kind of guys that grab me. It's the people on the fringes who are brought into the universe that I find much more interesting.
Yeah. And the thing is this, is that T'Challa kind of straddles both of those. He's both Iron Man, but at the same time, he is also Ant-Man. Because what you have is this. You have a character who, against his own culture, is saying, you know what? I'm going to help.
Yeah.
I intend to help. Yes, I know we turned our backs on everything. We even turned our backs on the rest of Africa. But no more.
Yeah.
No more. I'm going to actually take a stand here, and we're going to make things better as opposed to just letting the rest of the world go to hell while we ourselves just stay where we are. Because eventually, it's going to find us. And we could have either been the individuals who helped out and made a difference, or we could be falling prey to something far worse.
Yeah, those...
And...
Sorry?
Yeah. No, go ahead.
Yeah,
go
what
ahead,
I was thinking is, that first post-credit sequence was the most powerful bit for me, because it was T'Challa saying where Wakanda is in the future, and it was a direct denial of kind of Trump's vision of America, building bridges
yes.
rather than building walls. That's mm-hmm. a really important
yes.
moment in there. And
yes.
I like that, yeah. and you can't make a movie like this without it being political. If you look back on the history of Black Panther, excuse me,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you go back to the Reginald Hudlin comics that he did. Mm-hmm. That was so overtly political and powerful for
yes.
that.
Yeah. Not just that, but even the Christopher Priest one
yeah.
goes far political, because you're dealing with the king who he joined the Avengers to spy on them. He saw superhumans as a potential threat to his realm. And so he says, okay, either they're our friends or we're going to have contingency plans against them.
Yeah.
I mean, in the comics alone, Black Panther has a contingency plan against Galactus, and he used it twice.
Yeah.
The last one literally turned Galactus into a life bringer as opposed to the death bringer of worlds. That's how far reaching, and you know, this guy has foresight to see what could actually go right and go wrong. Now, I will say this, in saying that, there are repercussions down the line because Wakanda has now gone public. I don't know how public they're going to go, but if it goes to the level I think it could go, they could very well, in the sequel films, they could possibly take elements of the recent run of Black Panther by Ta-Nehisi Coates and Brian Stelfreeze called A Nation Under Our Feet, which is the first volume in a larger story. And you deal with the ramifications of a very destabilized Wakanda because of T'Challa's interaction with the rest of the world. Because you said, okay, I'm going to help out, but you got to be careful with who you help out.
Yeah.
Not all aid is going to be right individuals. And, you know, it's good to actually have a big heart, but you have to have a big heart, but you always got to keep your eye on the ball.
Yeah.
And so, say in the next one, or maybe the third film, they bring in the son of Obadiah Stane, Ezekiel Stane. And he's possibly like the Marvel version of Lex Luthor. He's a corporate tycoon, nation destabilizer, and that's all he does all the time. It goes around the planet to get markets in and destabilize countries and so forth to make those markets, you know, more fruitful for the shareholders. And he sees that they could do the same thing with Wakanda.
Not that could happen in real life, yeah.
Happen. Exactly. And that's like I said, that is the unfortunate byproduct of them going public, is that they can open themselves up to that. And for that would be both interesting storytelling, but at the same time, I really don't want to see that because I want to have Wakanda remain as strong as it has. Does it have to change? Yes. But the structure that they have has been there to protect them, but they now have to be able to adapt and improvise.
Yeah.
And they got to do it smart. But they also got to go after those who would be the oncomers who would say, okay, I think I can take down Wakanda now.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that's going to make T'Challa or break him. I love this. The things that got me teary-eyed, I'm not going to lie to you, that was a bunch of them, was the scene where he finally sees his father in the afterlife.
Yeah.
And he kneels before his father, and his father is saying, why are you kneeling before me? You're a king now, and so forth. T'Challa, it's one thing to be trained to become the king. It's another thing to become the king.
Yeah.
He, in the initial part of it, he was unsure. He was saying, I'm just your son, you know. Yes, but at the same time, you are now the king. What are you going to do? He does not become the king until that revelation of what happened. He talks to his father and saying, I love you, father, but I cannot come with you.
Yeah.
I must go back. I must right this wrong. That was when day one for T'Challa, him becoming the king.
Yeah, being a king on his own terms.
On his own terms, as opposed to what he thinks others want of him. He says, you know what? Right or wrong, I don't know where this is going to go, but I got to right this wrong. Because you could have brought him back with you. You could have brought Eric back with you. Why did you not?
Yeah.
And like I said, you know, this is Game of Thrones on a lower level, but on a better level for me, because I'm not really that big of a fan of the series. But that's what they did for the Marvel Cinematic Universe with this story.
Yeah.
Because you're seeing all these oncomers. You're seeing my boy M'Baku. And as far as where the most valuable players in this movie, you got M'Baku and you got Shuri. For me personally, I never laughed so much and cared so much than when those two were on the screen.
I loved M'Baku's throne room. The production design on all the way through, but in that one particularly, is brilliant.
Yeah.
I just love the whole look of it. I love the Afrofuturism look of Wakanda. I like Shuri's lab, which is the kind of lab a teenage girl in a high-tech African society would have, with the bright colors and the murals on the walls and the whole lot of it. It was just beautifully thought out, and it's unlike anything you've seen in cinema before, which is the beauty of it.
Yeah, it's funny, and this is as far as for me personally, I will never be able to have a little sister. I did. She's no longer with us. She passed like over 30 years ago. But when I look at Shuri, I have to ask myself, would my baby sister Lisa have been like her? Would she have been that much of a kidder, a smart ass, and so forth? But at the same time, sure of herself and always, you know, joking around, but just being full of life.
Yeah.
And that's what Shuri was to her brother, because he said, hello, my king. He said, don't call me that. And, you know, you just sit and see, you know, big brother, little sister banter. And I'm saying, this is all I need. This is all I need.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, all these elements is the reason why, for me, this is my favorite Marvel Cinematic Universe movie. And like I said before, it's not perfect by any stretch of it. But for me personally, this worked.
Yeah.
For everything I wanted and things I didn't even know I wanted. It was.
Yeah, and the characters felt lived in as well. That relationship between Shuri and T'Challa felt lived in.
Yeah.
It felt like they'd been doing this for years together. And that kind of acting is the stuff you look for when you're seeing movies. You want to know that the relationships between the characters, just by the way they play with each other and the way they react to each other. And one of the interesting things about this is it's a family drama in a lot of ways, and it's the biggest family you've got in Marvel so far in the MCU. There are a lot of, you know, only children in Marvel's universe. And having one where not only is there a family, but there is a tribe, there is a nation of tribes, and there's an extension of that in that last scene to encompass the world. And that kind of that kind of community building is a really important message for people to hear and for people to embrace in these times.
It really does, because this film, other than being about the heart and soul of T'Challa, it was about the heart and soul of Wakanda. Really, even the heart and soul of Eric Killmonger. You had a lot of microcosms and macrocosms in this film, you know, where one affected the overall story and how to reconcile everything that you have now found out. And, you know, that's why I love so much, but also to see that play out in that big battle between all the tribes, the tribes that sided with Eric Killmonger versus the tribe that stayed true and honorable and said, we're still behind our king, T'Challa, all the way, especially the Dora Milaje. Yep. And my God, I cannot wait for to see, I'm sorry, Terry, I can't wait to see the Black Panther. I can't wait to see the Black Panther and the Dora Milaje and Captain America and Black Widow team up together to deal with Thanos' forces in Infinity War. That is going to be to see Black Widow and the Dora Milaje kick butt together. That's especially Okoye. Okoye, Okoye and Nakia. Okoye was, this way I look at it, was T'Challa's work mother. She was the one who kept him on the straight and narrow when Ramonda wasn't there. When he's out in the field, he's got Okoye. But Nakia is his heart. Yeah. Nakia is the one that, and I said this in my review, that Derek Ferguson posted on his Ferguson Theater website. I said that Nakia was his heart and the woman that all men need.
Yeah.
A woman who will pretty much tell you right from wrong, who will be put you on the correct path. And even if you're not on the correct path, they will still love you regardless.
Yeah.
You know, that's who Nakia is. I mean, I know people are waiting for Black Panther and Storm. That would be nice. Mm. But if she never, ever appears and they never, ever get together in the MCU, Nakia is just queen.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about Okoye is her title is Hand of the King. So she's there to be that advisor and to be the person who will say, no, that's stupid or that won't work. So her advisory capacity is an important one in there as well. So you've got the heart with Nakia, and you've got Okoye being the tactician and the kind of military leader advising him.
Right, and even though she knew, and even though she knew that it was wrong to have Killmonger on that throne, she still says, I'm still staying at my post. Because at the end of the day, me being the hand of the king is being the protector of Wakanda.
Yeah.
That maybe, just maybe, with exposure, maybe we can be able to make something right out of this.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I'm looking forward to with the MCU as well is I wish Captain Marvel was sooner so we get a female-led MCU movie to kind of rival the way Wonder Woman was for DC. I think that that time has come and it's well past come. We're 10 years into the MCU.
We should have already had a Black Widow.
Oh, absolutely. We should have had a Black Widow. We should have had a Captain Marvel.
It's a shame. It's a shame. But at the same time, I understand as far as where the narrative, but you guys have all this money. You got all these resources. You could have some time last year had a Black Widow film where it's her on the run trying to get to Wakanda to get to Steve and get to Bucky. And in between, she's being hunted by elements of old Hydra and Leviathan who are on her tail, as well as Everett, you know, K. Ross and his people, because she's wanted because she sided with Cap during Civil War. And to go from there, and then we get to see the backstory of how she became. I mean, there were so many ways to do this, and now they said, oh, we're going to do it. Well, it's almost too little too late, Kevin.
Yeah.
You know,
we need it, and I know there are a lot of female friends of mine, some of whom podcast, who are a bit disappointed that it hasn't happened by now. But one of the things that's going to happen is when Infinity Wars finishes, that opens up a ton of possibilities because Infinity Wars is taking up all the oxygen to a certain extent. And telling stories from other viewpoints is going to happen after that kind of enormous wave passes. And they can tell smaller, more intimate MCU stories. They can still do big blockbuster ones with a new character arc and a new plot arc, but I really want to see a lot more diversity. I want to see the Shang-Chi one because I was reading the comics when they came out, and they were great. I mean, you know, Son of Fu Manchu, you've got the James Bond linkage with Clive Reston in there, you've got Black Jack Tar, you've got everybody in there, and it would be just such fun to see, and I think it could play really well 21st century audience, and there are action stars that could do it. You could get Iko Uwais, who was in The Raid, to play Shang-Chi.
Absolutely.
There are a couple of other actors as well you could get to play Shang-Chi.
Yes, you could.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the thing that I ended with my review, is that's what makes Black Panther so important, is because it kicks the door in. And what happens is this: you get all these possibilities after the fact. Because let's be honest here, Infinity War and the fourth Avenger film will possibly be the last Avenger film we will see in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Their age is coming to its end. What happens after them is what's going to be more interesting. Do we go into the Ultimates now with Black Panther, Blue Marvel, Captain Marvel, Monica Rambeau, America Vega, and maybe even Scott Lang, and, you know, who knows, you know, the girl who's playing Wasp, yeah. You know.
Eventually.
They might become, yeah, exactly, who, you know, they could actually do the Hope, you know, Hope Pym. She might be, you know, a member of this group. Because the thing is this, is that I've been watching the Avengers Assemble series. Now, I know a lot of people, they don't like it. They like the original series beforehand. And I could see some of their points for that. But at the same time, Marvel's been very, very strategic, as well as very interested in the story arcs that they want to make happen in the MCU. And I'm saying that because when I look at Avengers Assemble and Ultimate Spider-Man and Hulk and the Agents of Smash, I'm seeing story concepts that the MCU could possibly use down the line. Yeah. It might not be exactly like that, but it could be something similar. So right now with Avengers Assemble, we have Black Panther, Captain Marvel, Miss Marvel, Ant-Man, Wasp, Vision. You have that group, and I'm saying to myself, well, hell, that's the new Avengers. But maybe the Avengers as we know them stop being necessary, and then we go from the Avengers to the Ultimates. Mm-hmm. And they there for one purpose, and that's Ultimate Solutions, because it's going to get more cosmic as we go forward. It's going to be smaller stories down on the ground, but out there, now that Disney has purchased Fox Studios for exorbitant amount of money, once the ink is done with that, we get the Fantastic Four, we get the X-Men. Yeah. But I don't see them immediately coming into the MCU. I see in particularly that Fantastic Four will definitely headline or be the driving force for Phase 4. But as far as with Phase 5 and Phase 6, that will be the X-Men coming in. And I've already on my own website, which is Luke Speculations, which you can easily find. I'll give you the show notes for that. Yeah. I already did my own theory pitch as to how you could do that to bring in the X-Men. Because the Fantastic Four is easy. Yeah. Now that we have the possibility of them, they could be linked with S.W.O.R.D. Because S.H.I.E.L.D. should have never just have been S.H.I.E.L.D. You should have had S.H.I.E.L.D. You should have had S.W.O.R.D. You should have Spear, which is like the Chinese counterparts and so forth. So you have all these different intelligence network agencies that are operating. But when it concerns the X-Men, and this is pretty much my life, me speaking pretty much into hopefully being, the reason why we don't have no mutants is because Professor X used to be sub-director of S.H.I.E.L.D. as the director of PsyNet or Psy Division. And when he found out about Hydra, he pretty much wiped all memories of mutants and telepaths. And he just decided to use all those resources, and he took it back to his mansion. And so the Institute has always been there. Yeah. And for some reason, it all gets exposed, possibly because of the fallout from Infinity War. We don't know what's going to happen, what reality changing or revelations are going to be exposed in this film after the fact.
Yeah.
But they could literally pepper all that in and say, huh, well, these mutants have always been with us. But why did we not know about this? It's all because of Xavier and his incredible mind.
Yeah, well, that's the problem with the MCU. Well, it's a potential problem, at least. They've got 55 years of backstory to play with in Marvel from the comics. In fact, as far back as World War II, of course, with the Captain America and the Human Torch and all those kind of things. Picking out what to do and what not to do and how to do it in a 21st century context is a hell of a job. It's a really, hard thing to do because you're flooded with really cool material and you can only pick out a little bit. And that's a crazy difficult thing to do.
It really is. And the things that this, you will have to really pay that person. It would literally have to be a bunch of people who would be the story narrators, the story editors, and the people who are able to go back and see what was done, and then be able to say, okay, is there a way for us to add something extra, maybe a little retcon, whatever, to make everything else that comes later actually make sense? Because where have the Fantastic Four been? For me personally, I would just say they were members of S.W.O.R.D., and S.W.O.R.D. was even kept secret because that's what Nick Fury wanted. Yeah. He didn't want the two organizations to even know that they even existed. And I'm not going to lie, the first season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., when Coulson went into that bunker and he found that, you know, Kree remains, and then he found out that this was what was being used to save his life.
Yeah.
I always thought that that group was actually S.W.O.R.D. You know, they were unnamed, but no, they were just, you know, a team of individuals that worked for, you know, that worked for Fury, that were off the books and so forth.
There are so many Easter eggs all over the MCU. Some of them they'll never hatch, but I think having the Easter eggs there gives them the option of going, okay, well, we're going to hatch that one and play it out. But the other ones, they can just sit there. We can use them later if we like. If we don't use them, that's okay. But seeding the MCU with little hints at things that you can later on tease out is one of the cool things about it.
And that's the thing about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is that it really is a gift that keeps on giving. Mm-hmm. Any which direction you go, whether it be the far past. And I just had a podcast last night with the Earth Station One podcast, and I was talking to the guys there, and I said, you could literally right now do a World of Wakanda Netflix series before they even decide to go over to the Disney streaming service and show the past Black Panthers from Bashanga all the way down to his descendants to see what they were doing. Like maybe one during World War One, or, you know, Azuri, Black Panther's T'Challa's grandfather, who, I'm not going to lie to you, as much as I love Wesley Snipes as Blade, there's still a part of me that says, let's still make this man Black Panther. He doesn't have to be T'Challa, but maybe we can make him Azuri.
Yeah, well, I think the problem with Wesley Snipes, though, is that he does have some issues, in a sense.
Oh, he does. I'm not going to lie about that. So, but he doesn't even have to be a full-on story. It could just be a bunch of flashbacks, you know, as T'Challa is reading the stories. It would cut back to whatever his character did. Now, it doesn't automatically have to be him, but he pretty much in the 90s was pretty much the guy that you put in and said, okay, I want to see a Black Panther movie happen.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why that film kind of tanked or didn't even come to be is because of the idea that John Singleton himself had as far as where that character is concerned. Now, I respect John Singleton, but his version of Black Panther is not the Black Panther that I grew up reading. And so that never would be able to translate. In fact, that possibility would have been held. If his movie had been made with what he had specified, it possibly would have been laughed out back then, just like people laugh at Steel with Shaquille O'Neal. That's how much of an issue that would have been.
Yeah.
And his heart meant well, but you cannot change the mythology that badly of a character and think that there's not going to be repercussions, even back then in the 90s.
Absolutely. This movie blew me away more than it blew Sally away, because I've got more backstory and more history with the Marvel Comics and with Black Panther as a character. But I love the texturing. I want to see a lot more Afrofuturism in future movies, whether it's MCU or not.
Yes, me too.
I want to hear other people's stories. That's one of the joys for me, is hearing stories from another viewpoint than my own. One of the things I've enjoyed over the last few years is an Australian series called Clever Man, which is an Indigenous superhero series using Aboriginal actors and writers and Aboriginal mythologies. It went to series, and I've just about a minute ago bought the second one on DVD because I've got series one.
Very good.
And it's a challenging one in the sense that if you're not familiar with all of the mythologies, it takes you a little while to get into. But if people can get a hold of that one, it really does do that really fantastic thing of showing us other people's stories. Even though it is a culture in my own country, it's very much a marginalized culture.
It really is. And sadly so. Yeah. And just to echo what you just said, I think that now with this, because of just how much money and how much exposure Black Panther has gained, you're going to see within the next 5, maybe 10 years, this drive to see more diverse characters, but diverse, not just for the sake of diversity, but just give us something that we've never, ever seen before, type of take. And what you're going to see is characters who initially were thought, well, I don't know if we can do anything. And people are going to say, you know what? Let's see what we can do with, say, the Night Thrasher.
Yeah.
Maybe we could get, what's his name, you know, the guy who's about to play Lando, Don yeah. Glover. You know, maybe he himself could sign up and do it, because that's who he was. When he was in Spider-Man Homecoming, that was the Night Thrasher, yeah. who was the uncle to Miles Morales. Mm. So you could either do him. And there's just so much. There's so much fertile ground to cover yeah. that you could do it forever if you wanted to. But the market has to be there. And that's the whole thing. That at the end of the day, the bean counters are the ones who matter when it concerns Hollywood. It's not the executives, it's not the producers, it's not the directors. It's the bean counters. So if people want that type of content, your ultimate power is in the ballot,
yeah.
is your dollar, where you spend your dollar.
Absolutely. And Black Panther being so wildly successful and being spoken about a lot, the fact that there was an alt-right backlash trying to mess with Rotten Tomatoes shows how strong it is.
Mm-hmm.
You're reflected in your enemies. Yeah. And mm-hmm. it didn't work, which is great, but the fact that they tried to shows
what a movement it is. I expected it, Terry. Yeah. I expected it, Terry, because they are who they are. And that's another thing about this film that's interesting is that even when Ulysses Klaue, definitely said this in my review, is that Ulysses Klaue was like Marvel's version of the Joker, yeah. writ large, is that you guys, racist, mad scientist, mercenary for hire, who got a big bone to pick with Wakanda because they've been hunting him for decades. Mm. But the reason why he wants Wakanda technology isn't for the right reasons. It's because of his own personal culture, his own worldview, yeah. and so forth. And it's being muted in the movies, but in the comics, they did not shy away. Reggie Hudlin's run definitely did not shy yeah. away from just how warped this man's mind was. And sadly, we exist in a world that people still think exactly like that. Now, most of it is because for them, they see the changing landscape. And for me, it's pretty much karma. Mm. You've had Africans, African-Americans, people of color for all across this planet who have been catching hell for centuries. And now, I am not going to say the other foot's on, you know, things aren't changing too much, but there is a change. There is a thing of, we're not going to, you know, allow you to go, you know, the way that we went, but don't try anything.
Yeah.
Because we're on to you. And so when I saw that thing with the down voting for Rotten Tomatoes, I say, yeah, it's standard operating procedures for these guys. Yeah. You know, they pretty much live, breathe, and think hate. Mm. Because for them, they have their own shortcomings. And really, we ask them, really, why do you believe what you believe and think what you think? It really comes down to a psychological issue of, well, I've always thought like this because this is how my family thought. But also on a personal level, they don't feel their own personal power.
Yeah.
You see, if you yourself individually feel your own personal power, you won't ever have to go with the herd. Mm. You always are saying, you know, I myself know who I am. I know my own value. I know my own worth. So I don't have to latch myself onto a type of power, you know, movement yeah. and so forth. I know that, you know, right from wrong. Now, if that movement is for the good of humanity, I will back you. But if it is not, and it's only for a certain segment, I'm not going to even give you the time of day, but I will always keep an eye on you.
Yeah. It's also the fact that all of that stuff's just based on fear. Fear that they'll yes. lose the power that they have and the privilege and the entitlement that they perceive they have. Mm-hmm. All of that kind of stuff. In my own life, the times when I've thrived is when I let go of being scared.
Exactly. And that's when you yourself find that you have more power. Yeah. than you thought you had.
Well, it's also giving up the control and the need to kind of try to control fate. There are times in my life when everything I was scared of happened, and I'm still here. You got to get past that shit because... and one of the other aspects, too, is that I've been a science fiction fan all my life, pretty much. And I despair for science fiction fans who get scared of the future. They're Luddites. They don't understand that the world is changing and that change, you can be part of it and make it a good thing, or you can be scared of it and be part of a bad thing. The future is going to be different than the past. And the thing we've got to do with that is make sure that everybody's got a seat at the table. Because if you don't do that, that's where your dystopias are. Everybody's got to have equal seats and an equal voice.
Right. I agree. And the sad part is just that the dystopian fiction genre has skyrocketed for the last 15 years because people seriously are absolutely afraid of what could happen even as of tomorrow. What could the world look like? And I don't have time for that, Terry. I have family that I love who they depend on me, I depend on them. And I can't fathom a world where everything just eventually goes to hell and everything's all misery and doom and gloom. No, I don't have time for that. I have a nephew who is going to be 7 months old very soon. And for his sake, this world needs to right all the wrongs. Because he's already in his own life going to have to do his part in order to keep this ship floating. Yeah. So it's upon us to actually help him out and help out all those kids so they can have something better.
Yeah.
And he gives, every time I look at him, he gives me perspective. And it's necessary perspective. And it goes back even to this film. Life's about perspective, but it's also this. You need to know who and what you are.
Right.
You need to know the good and the bad and the ugly.
Yeah.
And you got to be able to reconcile that, and you got to be able to go forward with that information. But you got to do it in a positive way where you're not going to say, I'm not going to allow this to turn me into a monster.
Yeah.
I'm going to become better than this.
Yeah.
And that's what it comes down to.
And that's one of the things that disturbs me, too, is there's so much dystopian fiction that's aimed at young people. There's young adult and teenage dystopian fiction.
Yeah, Maze Runner, Hunger Games. I mean, okay, well, guess what? They still show that there's heroes, but guess what, guys? Even Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., with their crazy run just now with season 5, the last scene is a hopeful scene from Broken Earth, where one of the characters looks at another character and say, she gave the kid an actual model of the Earth and said, well, here's your blueprint. Because he now has the ability to use rocks. And he can gather rocks from anywhere in the cosmos, whatever, to rebuild what? Earth.
Yeah.
You have to be able, when everything goes to hell, to be able to say, okay, I'm still here. I am still breathing. It is hell itself, but I can make it through.
Yeah.
And some people, they can never, ever do that, and for them, my heart goes out to them, but they have to, because if not, then those who made your lives all that great in the good times, they failed.
People talk about opening Pandora's box with technologies and with social changes and things like that. They forget what the last thing in the box was, which was hope.
Yes.
And even if the world changes enormously and very fast, you've got to hold on to that last thing in the box.
Absolutely, Terry.
Okay. Well, we probably should end it there, mate. I'll let you get on with the rest of your day. But thank you very much for giving us your perspective on Black Panther and a bunch of other stuff as well. I'd love to get you on again,
Terry,
in future for the podcast, if that's okay with you.
I would love to, Terry. You just let me know when, and we'll set it up.
Okay, well, you take care and keep fighting the fight.
You too, buddy.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye. So that was my conversation with Lucas Garrett about Black Panther. I'm sorry about the sound quality. I'm not sure what went wrong there, but I wanted to persevere with it. I didn't realize at the start that it was happening, but I wanted to persevere with it once I did realize it was going on, because we were having just such a good time, and it was so useful getting Lucas's view on life in general and Black Panther in particular. So I'm going to end it there. The credits will come up next. Thank you for listening. Hopefully the next one we do has better sound quality. I really do apologize about that. But if anybody persisted this far, thank you very much for that. Anyway, in the meantime, look after yourselves. Keep watching the skies. Keep looking after each other. Watch bad movies. Watch good movies. Watch really bad Netflix science fiction movies. Whatever you like. But take care. I'll be back with Paleo Cinema Podcast in a week and Martian Drive-In Podcast in 2 weeks. I'll see you then. And here are the credits. Thank you to Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris our Music Director, Jan our Dialect Coach, Armin our Key Grip, Matt, our Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine, our Scientific Advisor, Julia, our Casting Director, Chris, the Camera Operator, Christopher, the Gaffer, Miss Jane, the Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy, our Foley Artist, Alyssa, our Location Scout, Mark, our Set and Unit Director, Paul, our Special Effects Makeup, Special Makeup Effects Director, Tammy, our Donut Wrangler, Tim, our New York Unit Director, Rabbi Steve, our Spiritual Advisor, Steve, our Monster Effects Guy, Dylan, our Goat Wrangler, Eric, our Set Security Lead, Richard H., the Set Photographer, Mark D., Extra, David L., the Extra, Richard C., our Transportation Co-Captain, Carrie L., our Tasmanian Consultant, and Kerry C., our accountant. We also have Sally, our continuity girl, and of course the other Sally, who is always helpful and encouraging and wonderful. So thank you very much to all of the Patreon subscribers. You too can be a Patreon subscriber by going to patreon.com/paleocinema and donating as little as $1 per month.